My name is Shelley Ziegler. I know most of you, but not all of you, but I am the director of the Blind and Physically Handicapped Library Services, which is, we are changing our name to the Talking Book Services. Some of you know that, some of you don't. It will be officially changed on Melvin on July 1st. So you might, if you call our agency and you hear us answer the phone, Talking Book Services, that is why, because we are slowly migrating over to that title. But you didn't come here to hear about me. Let me talk about my friend and our speaker, Mike Duke. We all know Mike Duke is the director of MPB's Radio Reading Service. And tonight we're going to get to know him a little better. Mike, blind since birth, attended the Mississippi School for the Blind. And from there he went on to attend Mississippi State University. And he earned a degree in communications. After that, he worked as a commercial radio announcer for 12 years. And then he joined MPB as the director of the Radio Reading Service. Mike and his wife, Kathleen, who is here today, live in Jackson. And Mike has been an NLS patron since 1963. I would just like to make a personal note. When I first came here and took this job 4 years ago as a director, Mike was one of the first people who really made me feel welcome and made me feel like I belonged here. So with that, I give you my friend, Mike Duke.
Don't go too far. They'll give me back. Thank you, Shelley. And thanks to everyone who made it out. I tried this afternoon to conjure up another snowstorm. But anyway, a few years ago at a Radio Reading Service conference, a lady did a presentation about books. And she opened with a piece that I found rather amusing. And I happened upon it by accident a while back, thanks to my friend Ed Potter in North Carolina, who had a collection of Jimmy Durante material for sale in his business. So I borrowed the title from one of Jimmy's pieces and thought I'd play the piece for you to get the night started. Everybody knows who Jimmy Durante is, was, guy with the big nose. This piece, and I decided to call my talk, The Day I Read a Book.
I can tell this isn't Durante's day, but folks, I've had my moments. Yes, I've had my moments. When I look back through life, I find lots of memories remain. Certain days stay in my mind and keep running through my brain. I remember the day that Edley swam the channel. What a flash! I remember the Wall Street crash, or when Winchell first shouted, flash! But there's one day that I recall, though it was years ago. All my life I will remember it, I know. I'll never forget the day I read a book. It was contagious, 70 pages. There were pictures here and there, so it wasn't hard to bear. The day I read a book. It's a shame I don't recall the name of the book. It wasn't a history, I know, because it had no plot. It wasn't a mystery, because nobody there got shot. The day I read a book. I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm gonna do it again. Why, if you walk into my house, you'll see loads of books. And believe me, they're not there just for appearances. I press an awful lot of butterflies. I know reading is relaxing. What did Napoleon do for relaxation? He read a book. What did Lincoln do for relaxation? He read a book. What does Congress do for relaxation? They book a red. You know, I'm familiar with all the bestsellers. There's the Encyclopedia Britannia, Forever Umbriago, and a new piece of significant literature which says, Atkit Kritkit. Ecke Engelappe, alle Molly Schui. How do you like that? I've been reading the life story of Mumbles. But I love good reading. Why, last week I spent 2 solid days in the library. Much to my regret, I buried my nose in a book, and what happened? I forgot which book I buried it in. Catastrophe. It wasn't a history. I know because it had no plot, it wasn't a mystery. Because nobody there got shot. One day I read a book, I can't remember when. But one of these days I'm going to do it again. Yes, sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
A little fun. A little fun from a music junkie and record collector, and an appropriate piece for tonight. As a child, my parents, as well as my brother and sister, often read out loud to me. And as I grew, their reading material graduated from the Three Bears and the Three Little Pigs and the ever how many numbers there were in the others, to include articles from the newspaper and some pretty doggone good descriptions of a variety of comic strips. So by the time I became a student at Mississippi School for the Blind when I was 5.5 years old, I was ready to learn to read, thanks to some very good teachers whose patience was tested on a daily basis by yours truly. I soon learned to read Braille. Learning to read Braille was great. It had a lot of advantages. Had some disadvantages, too. Every time some relative would show up, here, read for Aunt Susie. Aunt Susie's grown. Why can't she read for herself? Wrong answer. But anyway, I learned to read Braille in the first grade. Also in the first grade, I was introduced to the talking book. The talking book that introduced itself to me was called Eddie and His Big Deals by Carolyn Haywood. Carolyn Haywood was a wonderful children's literature author from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the big one, not ours. That book was narrated by, or as they said in those days, read by Milton Metz. And it also, at the end of the record, it would say, end of page one, turn the record over, and you turn it over, page two, as opposed to side one, side two, like we do now, or like we did for a while until we got barred. Anyway, Milton Metz read Eddie and His Big Deals. Eddie Wilson was the character's name. He and I had a lot in common. Like Eddie, if I didn't have a lot, you know, stuff to do, I could get in trouble very quickly. And just like Eddie in the book, Mike in real life wanted to know how stuff worked, and Mike wanted to make stuff work, whether he knew how it worked or not. And that sometimes created some interesting scenarios. I continued to read books from the library at the Mississippi School for the Blind all through high school. And as Shelley said, in 1963, when I was 8 years old, I also became a patron of the National Library Service Braille and Talking Book Program, or whatever it was called back then. At that time, there was no library in Mississippi. Our books came from Baton Rouge. Despite the fact that they came from Baton Rouge, that meant I could keep right on reading through the summer while my mom was at work or, you know, so forth. It also gave me a reason to meet the mailman every day, seeing if he brought me a new book. Now, my summer reading in those days included books such as The Adventures of Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain. And yes, I read the sequel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. I read lots of other current juvenile fiction of the day. And in the nonfiction department, one of the most fun books that I ever read was Contiki by Thor Heyerdahl. And I thought it was really cool to be floating around out in the Pacific on a balsa wood raft. Reading also gave me a big push toward my career in broadcasting. From as far back as I can remember, and some of you know this, I've always been fascinated by anything to do with radio. When I was 4 years old, I remember telling my mom one day, when I grow up, I'm going to work at the radio station, and I'm going to drive a station wagon. Well, now, how many people do you know that achieve 50% of their goals in life? I mean, hey, it's a good thing I didn't drive the station wagon. But I did go to work in my hometown radio station. That was my first job. My first job in radio. When I was in the 6th grade, though, getting back to the reading, the subject at hand, that fascination for radio led me to a life-changing encounter with a Braille book at the school library. Its title was How to Become a Radio Amateur. And if you don't know what radio amateurs are, the other translation of that is ham radio operators. Now, that book was written by an organization of ham radio operators called the American Radio Relay League. The organization is still there, and I'm a member of it, so is Kathleen. Thanks to that book and to a correspondence course offered by the Hadley School for the Blind, in 1969, at the age of 14, I passed the test for my first ham license, and as most of you know, I've been continuously licensed and active as a ham radio operator for the 46 years since. I should also add, thanks to the math teacher at School for the Blind, Nelda Hardage, because as I was studying the electronics, I had not yet had algebra. And I encountered some math, and I had no idea what to do with it. I didn't like math in the first place. So I took this electronic formula to the math teacher, to Ms. Hardage, and I said, can you tell me what I'm supposed to do with this? Now, she didn't know electronics, but she knew math. And she said, come by here, whatever time her vacant period was, and I'll show you. So I did that. And I sat there with the Braille writer and an abacus. She went up to the board because she always wrote her numbers on the board so she could see what she was doing. And she started calling out numbers to me and showing me when to multiply and when to divide this basic electronics equation known as Ohm's Law that expresses a relationship between resistance and voltage and current in electronics. You don't get very far if you don't understand that, in electronics anyway. So she starts giving me all these numbers and I'm working these problems, and in a few minutes she said, okay, I think you've caught on. And I'm about halfway out the door. She said, wait a minute, come back here. And then she said something that made me say, uh-oh. She said, when you land in algebra class next year, don't you tell me it's hard. You just had the first 9 weeks of algebra in 15 minutes. So my fascination of radio actually got me through algebra. As I learned more about how radio worked, I grew more determined to have that career in broadcasting. That determination ultimately led to my degree in communications at Mississippi State University. And, you know, a degree says you know on paper how things work. And then you go to work and find out how they work. And that's kind of what happened to me. I went to work at my first radio job in 1976, and I've been constantly employed, continuously employed in radio ever since. You can learn a lot from books. Sometimes learning what to do with what you learn from books is something you don't learn from books. Let me give you an example. There was a writer in the early 1900s, around 1901 or 2, named Will Henry. Will wrote some westerns and some Civil War books. One of his Civil War books was made into a pretty famous movie. In fact, the movie's probably more famous than the book. The book and the movie were called Journey to Shiloh. The movie Journey to Shiloh used to show up on all the late night movies on, you know, Saturday night when they'd run a movie after the 10 o'clock news, or sometimes on Friday. You'd see Journey to Shiloh for several years. I hadn't seen it in many years, but it's still out there. I think you can even get it on DVD. All I can say about Will Henry's writing style is he must have had a bet with somebody about how many swear words he could put in one sentence. Now, this was, you know, he was writing in 1900, so you didn't get the F-bomb and some of this other stuff, but you got, you know, God damn it to hell, every other sentence, you know. And the thing to do at School for the Blind, somebody would have that book, and they'd have these wonderful old talking book machines that played rock and roll really good, you know, and so they would open the door and crank that up, you know. Well, everybody sooner or later got bored with it and they went on to other stuff, which was probably a good thing for us and the house parents. But anyway, but I don't think I've seen a book that had as many swear words on one page as Will Henry put in Journey to Shiloh. So as I say, you can learn a lot from a book. Sometimes you just don't learn what to do with it. Rather, you may learn what not to do with it. While I was in college, I depended on books from what was then known as Recordings for the Blind. It's now known as Learning ALAC. When I began college, the books from Recordings for the Blind were on reel-to-reel tape. They had graduated from sound sheets and moved to reel-to-reel tape. And later, they changed over to the four-track format that became standard at NLS, and I sure was glad when they did that. A supplemental reading assignment for a college history class was the book All Quiet on the Western Front. And All Quiet on the Western Front was a World War I novel written toward the end of the 20s by a German author named Erich Remarque, spelled R-E-M-A-R-Q-U-E, and pronounced Remarque. That book, along with several other supplemental reading assignments during my college days, was supplied by this library, not by RFB&D. I could have probably gotten it from them, but I would call down here, and whoever was taking calls that day would look, and if they had it, they'd send it to me. Now, the All Quiet on the Western Front assignment was made by a history professor who the first day of class, and this was a summer school class, which meant it met 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. The first day of class, this guy walks in and told us what his name was, and he said, "Now, if you want a basic, this is what happened and when and where, go get a drop slip and I'll sign it and we'll both be happy, because that's not the way I teach. I want you to learn history and learn how to apply it and learn how to think through it and all this stuff." And he says, "And besides that, I'm a tough old so-and-so, and anything you get in here, you're going to earn." Well, he'd laid down the guidelines and the rules. Most of us had to have the class to graduate, so we didn't have any choice but to stay. So I read All Quiet on the Western Front, and he didn't give multiple choice tests. He gave essay questions. He'd ask a question, and you'd write about it. And I took my college exams with a lot of my professors. I would go to their office and they'd read the questions to me and I'd answer the question and then they'd give me the grade. Well, this guy had it down to a fine art. I might as well have been talking to a doorknob. He gave me no indicator while I was answering the question whether I was on the right track or out in left field or some other planet, which is good. I mean, that's what he was supposed to do. He wasn't supposed to lead me toward any answers. And this guy was really good at not doing that. He had said, "I'm a tough old so-and-so." Well, he comes to the last question of the exam, which is about All Quiet on the Western Front. The question was, "What stands out most in your mind about this book?" I said, "Well, I found myself when the group of young soldiers that the book was written about were in a jam, and they were being pursued, I'd say, 'Run, boys, run. No, not that way. This way. Go that way. Don't go over there.'" And then I realized, this is the enemy. He's writing about German soldiers. I'm supposed to be yelling, "Get them, get them." And so that's what I told him. He said, "What do you think caused you to have that reaction?" I answered with the only thing I could come up with, and that answer was, the author wrote in such a way that made you become part of the people, not just part of the war. The man clapped his hands, jumped up out of his chair, and he said, "You got it. You're the first person that ever gave me that answer, which is one of the answers I've been looking for a long, long time." Well, I got out of the course with a good enough grade that made me happy. But at the same time, I realized that day I had finally connected with this guy and kind of understood a lot of his teaching method and, more importantly, his testing method. And so that enabled me to finish up that course. But I never will forget this guy who says, "I'm a tough old so-and-so," getting as excited as a kid when I gave him the answer, because the writer caused you to become part of the people, not just part of the war. If you've never read All Quiet on the Western Front, it's a pretty moving story, and you will forget that you're reading about the enemy. Well, through the years, we had cassettes, and everybody knows about cassettes and sound sheets and so forth. And then along comes Bard. Yay! Now, one of the several things I like about Bard and that I've really enjoyed about Bard lately is having an adult encounter with several books that I read as a child, young child, and even a high school or college student. Some of the examples of books that I've enjoyed rereading: the Henry Huggins series by Beverly Cleary, boatloads of Henry books, Henry and Beezus and Henry and Ribsy. Ribsy was his dog, and some other stuff. Those things were as funny and as cool now as they were when I was reading them in the early 60s. Another one I read, just started reading again, actually, Little Britches, Father and I Were Ranchers by Ralph Moody. There's a whole, I think there's 8 books in that Little Britches series, and they're all up on Bard now. Maybe one of them is still not, but I think most of them, I think they're all up there. But the one I had the most fun with recently was Cheaper by the Dozen by Frank B. Gilbert Jr. and Ernestine Gilbert Carey, about a family that had a dozen children. Now, the last time I read Cheaper by the Dozen, I was somewhere in junior high school. And I knew it was a funny book. I remembered some of the lines. Their line about if somebody said they needed to visit Mrs. Murphy, that meant it was time to pull the car over and hit the woods. I remembered the story about Mr. Gilbreth when he was courting the lady who became Mama Gilbreth, was trying to be prim and proper. He was from Boston or somewhere on the East Coast. She was from the West Coast. And so East Coast was trying to impress West Coast and trying to remain dignified. And he had a horseless carriage. And this was like 1905. And so they're going somewhere and the thing stops in the middle of town and he has to get out and work on it and make it go. And somebody comes by and says, "Hey, Noah, where are you going with that ark?" And prim and proper, Mr. Prim and Proper, East Coast guy, just completely lost it. He says, "I'm collecting animals like the good Lord told me, and all I need is a jackass. Hop in." Well, Prim and Proper Lillian, the girlfriend, totally loses it and just turns inside out laughing, and the rest is history, and they got married and lived happily ever after through 12 kids. And I won't tell you this one except to say that one thing I had completely forgotten about in that book occurs near the end of it. And it's an episode relating to after the two oldest daughters, Anne and Ernestine, were up in high school and maybe one of them in college. You know, they were old enough that somebody would want to know what was under all those buttons, right? So one of them came to the other one night and said, "There's a peeping Tom outside my window in the cherry tree, and I think I know who it is. Shall I go get Mother?" And the other one, and the one who she went to said, "No. Leave Mother alone. She'll come out on cue at the right moment. But we're going to take care of Mr. Peeping Tom." Well, this occurred in the early part of the 1900s, so they did not push up the window and blast the guy out of the tree with a .357. They got rather creative about how they disposed of the Peeping Tom, and I'll let you read the book to find out how they did it. But it's one of the funniest things you'll ever read. One thing I find interesting in reading is how a writer will often weave the reading of books into the plot of his own story. There are a couple of examples of that, and maybe more, but two that come to mind in the writings of Louis L'Amour. One is from a book called The Cherokee Trail. Cherokee Trail is about a lady who leaves Civil War-torn Virginia to head west to join her husband as the operator of a stagecoach stop along the Cherokee Trail. And on the way west, she learns that her husband has been killed. Well, she gets there and takes over the station before anybody discovers that she's a woman. You know, this is 1860 some odd. Women don't run stage stations. They do in this book. So this lady, whose name is Mary Brighton, is the main character. And one of the other characters in the book is Temple Boone. Now, Temple Boone is your stereotypical Western gun guy. You know, if you're smart, you keep your hands in plain sight when he's around. But he has become a regular around Cherokee Station. And one day in Chapter 6, he says, talking to Mrs. Brighton, "I seen you unloading some books. Do you read books like that?" "I do," replied Mrs. Brighton. "Never read me many books," he said, embarrassed. "Always figured to, sometime. Once I worked in a store back in Missouri. They had all manner of books. Folks going west used to buy them. I just couldn't believe there were so many people who not only could read, but wanted to." Mrs. Brighton goes on to say that if one has a book, one is never alone. Books will talk to you when you want to listen. And when you're tired of what they're saying, you simply close them up. And they'll wait for you to return and open them again. And there were several other instances in that story where the lady, Mrs. Bryden, was reading to her daughter and some others, and Mr. Boone was somewhat surreptitiously lurking around and listening to the reading. Another great example of working the reading of books into your own story is in the Louis L'Amour book, Riley's Luck. Riley's Luck is about a young man named Valentine Durant. They call him Val through most of the book for short. When Val was 4 years old, he was taken, allegedly, to spend one night with Will Riley. Will Riley is a professional gambler. He needs a four-year-old like he needs a hole in the head or a run of bad luck. That one night turned into a lifetime. He was basically abandoned on the doorstep of this professional gambler. And in chapter one, they get right to one of the points about the books. In chapter one, it says, it was broad daylight when Val opened his eyes. Carefully, he got out of bed so as not to disturb Will Riley. On a stand near the window were six books, all much worn. He picked up one of them and turned the pages. But he was disappointed there were no pictures. Remember, he's 4 years old at this point. Still holding the book, he walked to the window to look outside. Soon he felt eyes upon him and turned around. Will indicated the book and asked, "Did you like it?" "There are not any pictures," Val replied. "Anyway, I like to hold it." Will gave the boy a thoughtful look. "Now that's interesting," he said. "So do I. I've always liked the feel of a good book." I will tell you, in case you want to read that story called Riley's Luck, there are at least six other places in that book where the possession of or reading of books play major parts in the plot of the story. And I just kind of found that amusing. I put together a list of some of my favorite books that I've read. Riley's Luck is in there, Cherokee Trail. A really neat biography called Pioneering on the Yukon, 1892 to 1917. This is about a lady who left Seattle in 1892 to go to the Yukon in Alaska to find her missing son and wound up spending 25 years there. She was 53 years old when she left Seattle. It was published after a grandson cleaning out his grandmother's house accidentally found a partially completed manuscript that she had started writing. Really, really neat story. Little Britches was on there, the Ralph Moody book. Mrs. Van Devender, the librarian at School for the Blind when most of us were there, had a bit of a sense of humor. If you remember, that library on the Eastover campus was right at the top of a set of stairs, and it was an open stairwell. And if you came out the door of the library and either weren't careful or deliberately talked just loud enough, your voice would just go rolling down that stairwell and the whole world would hear it. I know from past experience. Sometimes the girls who used the stairs on that end of the building would use the windows on the landing of the stairs to store stuff that wouldn't fit in their lockers. And so Ms. Van delighted in coming out and calling a girl by name and saying, "Jane, come back here. You left your little britches in the window." Well, she was talking about the book, Little Britches. And she knew that, and everybody else did, but it was funny as heck. Anyway, I put that one on there, along with, another great one. Defended Baltimore Against Enemy Attack, A Boyhood Year During World War II. It was written by Charles Osgood, and it's one of the commercial audio books that NLS is now starting to distribute some. So it was actually read by Charles Osgood. You know, Jack Fox could have read it and done a great job of it, but it was really good having it read by Charles Osgood. And he talks about how he was just sure he was saving Baltimore from the enemy by planting a victory garden, and then he realized his victory garden died, you know, and stuff like that. There's a book called Charlatan, America's Most Dangerous Huckster, The Man Who Pursued Him, and The Age of Flim Flam. A lot of radio history in that book. But the book is about a fake doctor, quack doctor named John R. Brinkley, and the stuff he did and how he was able to get away with what he did for as long as he did. This is going to lead to one more Ms. Van story. I have a section on here called Judging a Book by Its Cover. Everybody knows you aren't supposed to do that. Let me tell you what happened one time. We had a secretary at school for the blind who ran the business office and tried to run everybody else's business. She called Ms. Van Devener, the librarian, in one day and said, "And just why and what were you thinking when you ordered a book called Whose Tail Is It, T-A-I-L? Whose Tail Is It was one of the, what they call now, I think, twin vision books. Had print and braille in it and had pictures. And it would show a picture of a beaver tail, and then it would have a little writing or a little write-up about the beaver and how the beaver used its tail and, you know, in the water and stuff. And this lady got all hot and bothered about a book called Whose Tail Is It? I don't know what she was thinking. Well, maybe I do know what she was thinking. But anyway. But Ms. Van looked at her and said very quietly, "You run the office, I'll run the library." And if you knew her, you knew if Ms. Van ever said something like that to you and said it quietly, there was only one answer, and that was yes, ma'am. So I thought of that when I wrote Judging a Book by Its Cover. These are books that I have not read yet, but whose title just makes me know I want to. Let me give you an example. Dear Mr. Rogers, does it ever rain in your neighborhood? It's by Fred Rogers, the late Fred Rogers, and it's obviously a book of letters written to Mr. Rogers. Melvin won't read this one. Mark Twain Made Me Do It and Other Plains Adventures by Brian Jones.
What's the number on that?
DB45583. Here's another one that would get the attention of the school secretary. Don't Pee on My Leg and Tell Me It's Raining. Now that's, of course, the book written by Judge Judy. I thought the title was rather creative. That's just a few of the books that, thanks to Bard, I've downloaded, and I can read whenever I want to get around to them. The Pratt-Smoot Act has empowered generations of people who are blind to become readers. The individuals and organizations who wrote that legislation and who worked hard toward its passage deserve every acknowledgement we can give them. Thanks to this legislation that we call the Pratt-Smoot Act, we can say, just as Jimmy Durante did, "I'll never forget the day I read a book." Certainly I will do that. If there's, you know, any questions about why did you stand up there and tell us all this stuff, or no, I would be glad to answer any questions. Melvin is speechless.
Could you repeat that? I'll be always
better. Mike, you've always been a big reader, and is it because of your family?
Probably so, because, you know, my earliest memories of my sister were, you know, sitting in her lap and her reading to me. And then she or my brother would come in after school and they'd read their homework assignment out loud to my mother. And I had no idea what they were reading necessarily in terms of what it meant. I just knew they were reading and I liked to hear it. And so, yeah, I think that having that many people reading to me, and my mom and dad didn't have more than a high school education themselves, so it wasn't like they were college graduates, but they would read to me. Partly to keep me quiet sometimes, I guess. But at the same time, they were smart enough to figure out that if they would read to me, I would want to learn to read. And and they would tell me over time that I would learn to read a different way from my brother and sister, meaning I would learn to read Braille. And they didn't know about talking books until I came home and told them, you know. So they were real happy about that. So, yeah, I think that being read to a lot from an infant on, you know, certainly had a lot to do with my desire to read.
You mentioned Bard a lot, so apparently you're a big Bard patron.
Oh, yes.
So, about how many books do you read a month, would you say?
I probably read at least one a week. I do a lot of my reading in the bathtub.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, you realize that's not good for those players, right?
Yeah, they don't float very well. The story was told on a teacher at School for the Blind. The story was told on a couple of sisters who taught there. They were twin sisters. Somebody made some comment about reading in the bathtub, and they said, and the question was asked by one of these sisters, "You don't read books in there read by men, do you?" It was a girl that had said something about it. And she said, "Well, of course," and of course that was the wrong answer. But anyway, and a lot of times I'll wake up in the night, and Kathleen loves the digital downloads because I don't have to very quietly, quote unquote, flip the cassette over, change side selector switch, you know, push the start button, all that stuff that she married into that she didn't know she had married into. Anybody else? Well, food was good. Oh my.
And it says certificate of appreciation to Mike Duke for outstanding performance and lasting contribution to the 84th anniversary celebration of the Pratt-Smoot Act of 1931 on March 26, 2015.
Hey, she even changed the date on it.
So if you wouldn't mind, if we took a picture with you holding it.
I don't mind at all.
Okay.
All right. Scared me. I thought for a minute she was going to have me take a selfie or something.